One lane closed due to the Corral fire. This is eastbound 580 between Corral Hollow Road and South Bird Road. Again, it's the right lane that is closed. The left lane is open. Both directions, or lanes, I should say, of westbound 580 are also open. I'm Joe Salvatore for KQED.
All right. Thanks, Joe. Thank you for your help again tonight. We've got It's Been a Minute coming up next. You're listening to KQED-FM San Francisco, KQEI-FM North Highlands, Sacramento, and the time now is 8 o'clock.
Hello, hello. I'm Brittany Luce, and you're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR, a show about what's going on in culture and why it doesn't happen by accident. A lot of us don't necessarily think of climate change as a cultural phenomenon, but today on the show, we get into how global warming might seep into our lives through where and how we live, and how it's starting to change the face of summer as we know it. Plus, it's prom season, and my guest says the fantastically bedazzled prom dresses we usually think of are starting to be a thing of the past.
You know, the prom dress trends are mirroring adult trends in a lot of ways. In some cases, adults are wearing the exact same dresses.
But is there a loss from the adultification of the prom dress? And later, how Fresh Air host Tanya Mosley reconnected with a long-lost relative, and how they turned their family story into an investigative series. All that and more after these headlines.
Live from NPR News, I'm Dale Willman. U.S. officials say they could be close to an agreement for a ceasefire in the Israel-Hamas war. President Joe Biden presented the three-stage plan to Hamas 3 days ago. Now, National Security Advisor John Kirby says it's a waiting game.
Where we are right now is that proposal, an Israeli proposal, has been given to Hamas. It was done on Thursday night, our time. We're waiting for an official response from Hamas. We would note that publicly, Hamas officials came out and welcomed this proposal. And so what would we hope would happen is they would agree to start phase one as soon as possible.
Kirby says if Hamas says yes to the deal, the White House expects Israel to sign on as well. Kirby was speaking on ABC's This Week news program. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says China is actively working to stop countries from attending a peace summit Ukraine and Switzerland are organizing for later this month. NPR's Emily Fang has more.
Zelensky alleged that China has not only avoided the peace summit, but has been blocking other countries from sending their leaders. He also said that last year, during a phone call with Chinese leader Xi Jinping, she assured him China would not send Russia weapons. But Zelensky said Ukrainian intelligence had found evidence that Chinese components were being found in Russian weapons. It is unfortunate, he said, that a big independent country like China is being used as a tool by Russia. Zelensky also said that he had not been able to meet with Chinese officials during his trip to Singapore, where China's defense chief also is currently for a security summit. Emily Fang, NPR News, Singapore.
Polls have now closed in Mexico's elections. Campaigning has been marred with a number of incidents of violence there. Just hours before voting began on Sunday, a town council candidate in a western Mexico city was shot to death by two hitmen riding a motorcycle. Of note in the voting, the country is likely to elect its first female president. 25 people were shot in Akron, Ohio this morning. One person died, and at least two others are in critical condition. And in Penn Hills, Pennsylvania, at least two people were killed and seven others wounded in another mass shooting. NPR's Amy Held has more.
Just after midnight Sunday in Akron, Ohio, police say a 27-year-old man was shot dead among 25 gunshot victims. Hours later, the mayor says the pain is reverberating across the city and asked for witnesses to step forward. There's no word about a suspect. Police say they removed a firearm and several dozen casings from the scene. It happened, they said, at a large gathering. Researchers who looked at 100 U.S. cities found as temperatures rise, so too do shootings. With more people getting together outdoors, interpersonal disputes, a top factor in gun violence, can boil over. Outside Pittsburgh early Sunday, Allegheny County police say a fight broke out at a hookah bar and lounge where multiple people opened fire, killing a man and a woman, and leaving several people injured. Amy Held, NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR News. It's been 1 year since Ajika A.J. Owens, a 35-year-old black mother of four, was shot through a locked door and killed outside her white neighbor's home in Ocala, Florida. Joe Burns with Central Florida Public Media says the family marked the end of a tough year with children dancing and poetry, along with chants of justice for A.J.
The neighbor, 59-year-old Susan Lawrence, claimed self-defense under Florida's Stand Your Ground law, and it was several days before sheriff's deputies charged her with manslaughter. Other neighbors said she would use racial slurs with Owens' kids. Owens went to confront her over mistreating her boys when investigators say Lawrence shot her. Owens' mother, Pamela Diaz, says the children, ages 4 to 13, need it to be over soon.
Every time there's a delay, the children think that maybe she's gotten out. They need closure. They need to know that she's been convicted. She's going to be behind bars for however many years it's going to be.
Lawrence pleaded not guilty and is in jail. Her trial is set for mid-June. For NPR News, I'm Joe Burns in Ocala, Florida.
Atlanta's water issues are beginning to subside. A collapse of corroded pipes on Friday led to a major outage that closed businesses and left faucets dry in many city homes. But officials today said water pressure is now returning to downtown Atlanta after crews repaired one of the two major water main breaks. A large portion of the city, though, remains under a boil water alert. John Force won a record 157th NHRA race on Sunday. Force is 75 years old. He beat teammate Austin Prock for the win in the Funny Car Final at the New England Nationals. I'm Dale Willman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. This is NPR.
Tomorrow, a partly sunny day with high temperatures from the low 60s at the coast to the upper 70s inland, and then prepare yourself. Temperatures are going to jump up quite a bit on Tuesday. For example, tomorrow in Livermore, 72, and then on Tuesday it should get up to 92. So by Tuesday and Wednesday, we're going to see highs in the 90s in the inland areas. Tomorrow in San Francisco, though, 66 degrees.
Hello, hello. I'm Brittany Luce, and you're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR, a show about what's going on in culture and why it doesn't happen by accident. This week, we're connecting the dots between summer vacation, severe weather, and homeownership. I know. How are all these things connected? Well, we're going to find out with NPR's climate correspondents, Lauren Sommer and Nate Rott. Lauren, Nate, welcome to It's Been a Minute.
Hi there.
Hey, thanks for having us.
I'm sure as climate correspondents, you get this a lot, but I feel compelled to ask, how is the weather where you are?
Whew. I'm in Ventura, California, and it is what we call May gray.
I'm in NorCal, but it is actually very hot here and not foggy for once.
Congratulations on not having any fog. That seems like it controls a lot of your area. Now, this is a culture show, and weather actually does determine a lot of our culture. It's a really present tone setter. It can make a day, ruin a day. It can determine a lot of what we can do and how we organize our lives. And it also has huge consequences. Over Memorial Day weekend, we know of at least 23 people who died in severe storms across the American South. We're talking about deadly tornadoes and lightning storms that took out power for hundreds of thousands of people. There were huge delays at airports across the Northeast. People were stranded for hours or days far away from home. This is all happening at a time when forecasters are predicting a summer with increasingly severe weather. Lauren, Nate, when we were preparing for this conversation, you both casually referred to this season as disaster season. And I mean, it rolled off your tongues because I take it you use the term a lot when describing the months we're about to head into. When did that change happen for you from talking about summer as just summer to thinking about it as disaster season?
You know, before I even started at NPR, I worked as a wildland firefighter and, you know, summer is fire season. Mm-hmm. And then when I started at NPR, you just find, oh, summer months is like, cool. You know, like I want to plan my vacation. My buddy's getting married. There's all these things right. happening you want to go do. But the reality is hurricanes happen in the summer. Wildfires happen in the summer. Mm-hmm. Heat waves happen in the summer. And so, you know, whatever plans you have are like to be disrupted. I don't know, Lauren, I didn't poison you with that idea of right of disaster season. You've thought that forever, right?
Yeah, we plan our lives for busy summers on the climate team at NPR. The federal forecasters just came out with the hurricane forecast for this coming year. They expect it to be the most active on record. 17 to 25 named storms. Like, you know how storms get names when they're really big storms. So I think we're still kind of just thrown back every year at just how much more extreme it is getting year to year.
If I step back and think about quote unquote disaster season, we know that these types of weather events are becoming more costly. And quite literally, Nate, I know you've done a lot of reporting on how this has impacted homeowners insurance.
For sure.
It's getting harder and harder to get that kind of insurance, not just in places like California and Florida, but also in places like Iowa or Utah. How has extreme weather caused by climate change upended the insurance industry?
So let me give you the short answer, right? Which is that like risks for insurance companies are now outweighing the potential profits in a lot of places. So the problem is in some parts of the country, like where we are in California, like in Florida and other kind of very climate vulnerable states, they're seeing so many losses that it's outweighing the money that these insurance companies are taking in. Or, you know, if that's not the case now, their models are telling them that it could happen soon. So that's why insurance costs are going up for everybody in the country, right? Virtually everywhere you're seeing insurance prices go up because the insurance companies are trying to cover their butts, basically, right? And make sure that they have enough money to cover for payouts. And that's why you're also seeing them just straight up get out of marketplaces.
If you want a mortgage, you have to have insurance, right?
Totally.
Okay, so the thing that I'm wondering is like, does that just mean that in the near future, more and more people are going to be unable to purchase a home? I mean, we're already in a housing crisis. How does this add to that?
I mean, it could totally make it worse. Yeah. You know, there's two things that happen, right? You could be a person that owns a house and then all of a sudden you're what they call home poor, right? You have a nice house, but you can't insure that house. Really, what you're doing is you're sitting on a huge liability. And I remember in Hurricane Harvey talking to people in Houston who had inherited their house from their parents, who had inherited it from their parents, and all of a sudden they're looking at this as like not this cool, awesome nest for their family over generations, but just it was becoming this giant liability. And yeah, I mean, if you're a first-time home buyer, if you want to buy a house and you can't get insurance on your house, no lender is going to be like, yeah, dude, take all this money. We'll lend you a bunch of money on this thing that you can't insure. So it does make the entryway into homeownership potentially a lot harder.
But yeah, as you said, there's a housing shortage in a lot of parts of the country, right? Like there's just not enough housing for people who need it. And so it's really a tough question for communities about building housing too, right? We need more housing. Where do you put it? And in a lot of places, it might be somewhere that's probably going to burn at some point. Or maybe it's near the coast and there's sea level rise and there's flooding, or there's a place where there's hurricanes. And so we see a lot of debates happening in local communities right now, which is like, okay, well, a lot of this housing was built when we didn't know or maybe didn't quite understand how bad the risks are. Now we know. Is it okay to build housing if people are going to be at risk in those places?
Thinking about the future, there are already so many people who have set down their roots in places where climate change is already impacting them, in some cases severely and in life-altering ways. These people can't just up and leave their homes, but it can be difficult to insure their properties. How are we going to adapt to this future?
Man, if I had the answer to that, I would not be working for public radio.
You would have sold it and you'd be sitting on a pile of money.
Yeah, I'd be buying houses with all cash. Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, like, look, there are ways to adapt and we're seeing that in a lot of places. So, I mean, like, look, with fire, it's like virtually every community in the country has something called defensible space planning, which is just like, I'm going to figure out a way to take vegetation away from my house. I'm going to make sure that my wood deck on the back of my house doesn't have a propane tank sitting under it, right? Like little things that you can do, change the type of roof on your house that actually do make a really big difference if you are in a situation where a fire is approaching.
Yeah, and it's interesting that in California, there are a handful of insurance companies that are giving you a small break on your premiums if you do prepare for wildfires. So they're starting to try to incentivize this type of preparation, but a lot of it's not
stuff we would consider super, maybe I'll try to convince you it's very sexy. It's stuff like infrastructure, but building codes really matter when you want a roof that doesn't blow off in a hurricane, right? Or flooding is a huge issue. I mean, that was what, 2021, when that remnants of Hurricane Ida kind of came through New York and New Jersey, there was horrible flooding, right?
We're not prepared. I don't think it's going out on a limb to say that New York City, or even the tri-state area, is particularly prepared to deal with that kind of very fast flooding.
Yeah. And it's not people that live right next to the water, right? It's just rain. It was rainfall. And that just points to kind of this like very basic issue, which is rainstorms are getting more intense. They're dumping more water. When that water hits concrete, it's got to go somewhere. And it needs to go in the storm drains. It needs to drain away. And that infrastructure just isn't able to handle all that water. And so there's an upgrading that needs to happen, right? We need to be able to handle all this water. And that's just the infrastructure. That's your storm drains. That's your wastewater treatment stuff. And so it's not sexy, but this is the stuff that really matters to people's lives.
I know you said it's unsexy, Lauren, but living in New York, I'm like, I actually would find new wastewater systems extremely sexy because street water is not sexy to me at all.
And Brittany, I think there's one very clear, shining, obvious answer here about how we can adapt. We could stop burning fossil fuels at the rate we are and contributing to the problem. It's happening. It's here. It's going to get worse. But the amount it's going to get worse really depends on the actions that we take today.
Huh.
The future is not set in stone here.
It's a choose your own adventure, but like not in a fun way at all. Yeah.
R.L. Stein didn't write this book.
And yet I still have goosebumps. Lauren, Nate, I have learned so much here. Thank you both so much.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, sorry to be your doomsayers, but climate change is real. Pay attention to it.
And as a thank you to both of you, I'd like to teach you something by playing a game with you all. Can you stick around for a tiny bit longer?
Heck yeah.
All right.
All right. Enthusiasm. We love it. All right, all right. You're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Brittany Luce, here with NPR's Lauren Sommer and Nate Rock. And we're going to play a little game I like to call, But Did You Know? Here's how it works. I'm going to share a story that's been making headlines this week. And as I give you some background on the story, I'll also ask you trivia related to it. But don't worry, it's all multiple choice. And the first one to blurt out the right answer gets a point. Person with the most points wins. And their prize is bragging rights, as I say every week.
I'll take whatever I can get.
Are y'all ready?
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Here we go. Maybe it's a plague. Maybe it's a miracle of nature. But no matter how you look at it, cicada broods 19 and 12 are emerging all over the Southeast and the Midwest. They're inescapable. Literally, they're all over the place in these regions. How many cicadas are expected to appear out of the ground, because they live in the ground, they come out of the ground, that's freaky, but how many cicadas are expected to appear out of the ground this year? Is it more than A, 1 billion with a B, B, 500 billion with a B, or C, 1 trillion with a T?
I'm going to go B, 500 billion.
I'm going to go A. Going conservative.
Well, you're both wrong.
Ooh.
The answer is
it's trillion.
C, 1 trillion with a T.
That's terrifying.
Exactly.
I mean, amazing.
I know, but terrifying.
I can't even comprehend that.
I can't, you know, either.
When it gets to a trillion, it's all just zeros. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. More than a trillion cicadas will emerge. And to put this in perspective, it's commonly accepted by entomologists that there's an estimated 1 million cicadas per acre. I repeat, 1 million per acre.
It's like zombie apocalypse in an insect form kind of thing, you know?
You got to respect the cicadas, though. You got to respect them.
Yeah. I know. Irrepressible. I'm like, I wish I had that kind of persistence, that kind of energy, that kind of consistency, that follow through to come back when I say I'm coming back. Okay. All right. So like I said, the broods emerging this year are broods 19 and 12. And it has been a long time since these two broods emerged at the same time. Who was the president the last time these two broods converged? Was it A, Woodrow Wilson, B, Abraham Lincoln, or C, Thomas Jefferson? Who is it?
I'm taking Jefferson on this one.
Let's go Honest Abe. You know, he never led us astray.
Well, the answer, Lauren, you're in luck, is C, Thomas Jefferson.
Oh.
This will be the first time in 221 years that these two broods converged. And for those of you worrying about these trillions of bugs, it won't happen again until 2244. So unless you've got cryogenic freezing money, I think you're safe.
Maybe not from the oceans, which will have risen by then.
Maybe not from the oceans. True. All right, to recap the score, Lauren, you're at 1 point. Nate, you're at a whopping 0 points.
Zero.
Without further ado, it's time for that final question. This one is winner takes all, because we don't do tiebreakers around here. We just finish.
Give the crown. I get it.
Choose your player. All right. There are two types of cicadas, annual and periodical. Both of the broods emerging this year are periodical, meaning they emerge every 13 or 17 years. You probably already knew that.
Totally. Yep.
But do you know the main way to tell annual and periodical cicadas apart? Is it A, the buzzing of their wings? B, the color of their eyes? I hope I never get close enough to one to know the color of their eyes. Or C, the length of their bodies?
I don't know why, but I want to say it's the color of their eyes.
It's a body. It's a body thing.
Yeah, morphologically, that makes more sense. Yeah.
All right, Lauren says C. Well, Nate, coming up from behind, the answer is B, oh, the color of their eyes.
Ooh.
Periodical cicadas have beady little red eyes. Annual cicadas have black eyes. And that's news you can use the next time you're picking up a cicada.
Crunch, crunch.
Crunch, 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 crunch. I'm actually glad you said crunch, crunch, because for those who don't know, cicadas are edible, actually. But they do belong to the shellfish family. So if you're allergic to shellfish,
don't go picking up cicadas and eating them.
Don't go eating them. That is it for, but did you know for this week, congratulations to Nate on your win. There you go.
I mean, that was a tie. That was a tie. Come on.
Nate, Lauren, thank you so much for joining me today. This has been a blast.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
That was NPR's Nate Rott and Lauren Sommer. I'm going to take a quick break, and when I get back, it's prom season. I'm getting into the fashion of high school's biggest night of the year. I'm Brittany Luce, and you're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Coming up tomorrow morning on Forum, a new book considers the promise and the peril of medicinal psychedelics through the lens of an ayahuasca retreat in the Amazon. We'll talk to the author. That's at 9 o'clock. And then at 10 o'clock...
I'm Mina Kim. Next time on Forum at 10 a.m., former White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki joins us to share the communication strategies and methods she learned in her rise to the most powerful communications role in the nation. Psaki says these strategies are applicable whether you're speaking to voters, the president, or a preschooler. Her new book is Say More. Join us Forum 10 a.m. on KQED.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from StoryWorth. Each week, StoryWorth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, they'll publish family memories into a bound book to keep forever. Learn more at StoryWorth.com. From Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at MadeinCookware.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
I'm Brittany Luce, and you're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR, a show where we talk about what's going on in culture and why it doesn't happen by accident. My big question this week is, what can changes in prom fashion tell us about what being a teen looks like today? It's prom season. And even though my prom was nearly 20 years ago and I have no desire to go back, I still love seeing the fun looks every year on social media. Not everyone goes to prom, but it's got this place in our culture as a rite of passage, a chance to get dressed up and act a little more grown up for a night. And there's definitely a trope for what a capital D dress should look like on this momentous occasion.
The stereotypical idea of the prom dress is shiny taffeta, big bedazzled moments, got ruffles, you got shimmer, you got this big like razzle dazzle moment.
That's Hillary George Parkin. She's a freelance writer with a focus on fashion and retail. And Hillary, she started to notice something. This stereotypical dress is not really what the teens are wearing anymore.
You know, the prom dress trends are mirroring adult trends in a lot of ways. In some cases, adults are wearing the exact same dresses.
So Hillary talked to teens and wrote an article about all this. And she found the prom dress's makeover is not just due to preferences. And the change in teen style goes beyond prom. The whole ecosystem of teen fashion is falling apart. To find out why, I sat down with Hillary to hear more about what the adultification of the prom dress says about the blurring of age and fashion. Hillary, welcome to It's Been a Minute.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Okay. So can I hear about what you wore to prom?
My prom dress was a lot like the prom dresses that I talk about in this article, which is to say it was quite casual. It was like a pale blue cotton halter dress.
Cute.
It's a nice color. Most of my generation and certainly my like friend group, I remember, was like Jessica McClintock.
Oh, yes.
Strapless. It was poofy. Yes. There were gemstones, which I love. Like, I remember looking back on them. I was like, oh, those are great dresses at the time. I loved them. Mine was a little bit simpler than that. But definitely, I was of the poofy, bedazzled era.
What year was it you went to prom?
2007.
Oh, okay. Okay. I went in 2005. And I wore, it was a Nicole Miller dress. It was silk cut on the bias. And it had like a lot of shell pink with like turquoise details, and it was paisley. My younger sister went in 2007. She had like a slightly poofy, like pale yellow with polka dots. But we're talking about prom dresses because you wrote an article about prom dress trends this year. What are you seeing in prom styles?
Yeah, so I think in general, the styles we're seeing are quite adult, which can look like many different things. There are popular prom dresses today that are coming from brands that generally do bridesmaid dresses. And there are others that look like something you might see on the red carpet. On the one side, kind of that simpler, more casual, a lot of floral prints, garden party look. On the other, this kind of slinky, sexy type of style. And both of those not being kind of traditionally teen looks.
So for your article, you talked to a bunch of teen girls. What was the image they wanted to achieve for their big night?
So I think one thing that these teens are prioritizing is kind of a longevity to their prom dress, something that they aren't going to look back on and be like, oh, I regret wearing that.
Hmm.
So I talked to one 18-year-old from Illinois, Grace, and she specifically said that she didn't want something to scream prom. So she found a dress that she loved on Pinterest, which was a common theme I heard, Pinterest being very big with the teens.
Mm.
Yeah, she thought it looked classic and beautiful. I think what she was saying that she wanted it to express about her was an element of individuality and a truthfulness to her personal style.
Hmm. It's interesting to me that Grace didn't want her dress to scream prom, or that there was this desire to come off as like more mature or composed. I mean, in my opinion, you know, based on my own experiences, teens have long wanted to seem more adult-like. And so it makes sense to a certain degree to me that we would see that reflected in prom styles. I wonder, in what ways is this trend toward more adult-like prom dresses old? And in what ways is this new?
What's different now, I think, is the access in general that teenagers have to the same influences, images, and retailers in many cases as adults.
Mm.
So whereas I was pouring through Teen Vogue as a 16-year-old.
Right.
They're on Pinterest. So on Pinterest, this dress comes up. It's decontextualized from where it's come from, what it is, which is a brand that largely does bridesmaid dresses. They're just seeing it as, oh, I love this dress. And it's maybe gone viral amongst teens who are into fashion on this platform and also amongst adults who are into fashion on this platform. So the influences are coming from different places. So it might be an influencer in their 30s who a 17-year-old follows right. and a 20-something follows and a 40-something-year-old follows. Like, there's an element of flattening across age boundaries.
You're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Brittany Luce, chatting with Hillary George Parkin about what changes in prom dresses can tell us about the blurring of age lines in fashion. Even beyond prom, it seems like the way teens take in any fashion content now is totally different. Like, teen magazines have taken huge hits. Many of them don't exist anymore or exist mostly online. How has the collapse of teen style media also collapsed what's aspirational for women of all ages?
Yeah, I think I don't know what women in their 30s were up to necessarily in 2005, but I think probably they paid less attention to what teenagers were wearing and doing. It's a hypothesis.
That's probably true.
So I'm sure I know more about what some 18-year-olds are wearing because they are being fed to me by these platforms. Like, I am seeing images of influencers of all ages who are often dressed in very similar ways. A lot of the trends that have come up in the past few years especially have been quite youthful, have been quite girlish, really. The bows, the coquette core, there's hyper feminine ruffles, and even beyond fashion with stuffed animals are super popular amongst adults.
Yeah.
I think there's kind of a breakdown of the boundaries between age groups, and especially when we are not necessarily dressing up for the office every day, or your office is open to jeans and a crop top. It changes what we used to think of. This is an adult outfit. Like, this is what I'm going to wear when I'm a grown up.
It's so interesting because it's so different from how you and I grew up and how, you know, many other people grew up experiencing teen fashion. But there have also been a ton of changes in retail that might contribute to this flattening. Like, the whole retail landscape for teens is different. Even just thinking about what stores are available for them to shop at. Like, a bunch of retailers that cater to teens and young girls, like Justice, Rue 21, Wet Seal, Delia's, Forever 21. I mean, they've all either closed shop or filed for bankruptcy in the past decade or so. So clearly, this isn't just about prom. This seems like it's about how teens shop in general.
Yeah, absolutely. The retail landscape has changed a ton for teens. There used to be a huge category of stores that specifically catered to teens that now just don't exist. And department stores too. I mean, that was a big place to go and get a prom dress.
Juniors departments, misses.
Misses, the misses, yes.
I remember my older sister going to the misses department too after she aged out of juniors. But yeah, a lot of brick and mortar department stores that have those specialized departments have closed stores along with the teen stores. And I kind of wonder, like, is it like a chicken and egg thing or something like that? You know, like, are the teens responding to the market around them, or is the market responding to the teens? I don't know.
I think it's a bit of both. I think as teens have access to more options outside of the stores and media outlets that are specifically catering to them, they're naturally going to look around and experiment and find new places they want to shop and new things they want to read. And at the same time, the fact that these stores then don't have as much traffic, they don't command the same market share, they are less influential, then they start to not have the cool things. They're not the places you want to necessarily go. Then that drives even more teens away. Then they start to close. And so then it's kind of this loop that keeps going.
You know, we didn't always have a separate category for teen style. I mean, the idea of teenagers was invented. It was an invented idea, and it was only invented less than 100 years ago. And it was really useful as an advertising category. Why did that happen?
It was related to more and more Americans going to and graduating from high school rather than entering the workforce right away. And they had unique culture. They had unique buying patterns. They would be advertised to in a specific way. Mm-hmm. And so teenagers were a unique category in a way that they weren't before that.
Of course, teenagers still have their own specific buying patterns, but at least from a fashion standpoint, it seems to kind of have dissipated somewhat as a distinct section along with, you know, the teen magazines. And I've been wondering if there's been some cultural loss there. I don't want to tell teen girls what they should or shouldn't do or what they should or shouldn't want to look like. I feel like they get enough of that already, but I do feel like being an awkward adolescent is like an important experience. Like, I went to my prom in 2005. You know, we didn't have makeup tutorials and things like that. And I do cringe when I look back at photos because I had no clue what to do with my hair or my makeup at all or my clothes at all. But also, societally, I don't think I was expected to, you know. But today, I mean, again, this is outsider looking in. It feels to me like because of all the tutorials and the products and the editing apps, because all of that stuff is available to teens now, it feels like it's also come with this expectation that, like the rest of us, that they're supposed to be polished and supposed to be put together. And it just feels like a missed opportunity for experiencing what it's like to have the space to be cringe.
Yeah, yeah. There's way more. It's not necessarily that more people are looking at them or that, you know, people do have these expectations, but more of a feeling that people do because they're seeing teens their own age on social media and adults on social media as well, who are put together, who do have a particular style, who do have that kind of polish. And so there is then that kind of internalized expectation of like, I have to live up to that. I should be wearing those clothes. I should be doing my makeup like that. The accessibility of makeup tutorials, I think, is a game changer. Really, they have ways to learn that just were never there before. You couldn't do that from a book.
No, couldn't do that from a book. But you know what, though? Fortunately, back then, also the pixelated digital cameras.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they were really not.
They're very generous.
They couldn't pick up. Yeah, they were very. They couldn't pick up on the details. So I'm like, too much bronzer? No problem. Hillary, thank you so much for coming on today and talking with me about prom style. So much fun.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Hillary George Parkin. You can find her article on prom fashion in The Atlantic. Coming up, I chat with Fresh Air host Tanya Mosley and her nephew Antonio Wiley about their new series, She Has a Name, and what it meant to investigate the disappearance of their loved one. I'm Brittany Luce, and you're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR. A quick heads up, this segment touches on a violent death. Does your family have secrets that they just won't talk about? Tanya Mosley's family had a few, and the silence around them was heavy. Until one day in 2004, when one of those secrets called her up.
He said, "My name is Antonio, and I am your nephew."
A surprise nephew was just the start. Antonio's mother was a half-sister Tanya never knew about. They had the same father, who kept his family separate.
What were you searching for when you contacted me?
My aunt. You.
And then Antonio told her his mother, Anita, disappeared back in 1987 when she was in her late 20s. In all those years, Antonio never stopped searching for his mother. Antonio called Tanya because he thought she might be able to help, but Tanya didn't have a clue. Then Antonio signed up for Operation United, a forensics program that aims to match DNA from unidentified bodies to family members. In 2020, he got a phone call saying they'd matched his DNA to a murder victim in an unmarked grave.
My mom's remains being recovered really gave us a platform for healing and reconciliation in our lives, too.
Antonio and Tanya turned their search for answers into She Has a Name, a documentary podcast series that unravels the mystery of Anita's disappearance and how her family has picked up the pieces without her. You might recognize Tanya Mosley as the host of Fresh Air, but today we're talking to Tanya and Antonio Wiley about how their documentary series breaks away from the tired true crime stereotypes. Antonio, Tanya, welcome to It's Been a Minute.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Yeah.
Oh, it's my pleasure. The show's title is She Has a Name. What was the significance of matching a name to Anita's story?
Well, I'll say first off, it meant the family knowing where she was all of these years. You can only imagine what it is like to hold the pain of uncertainty and confusion over the disappearance of a loved one and not have any answers at all.
Yes, and we even hear some of that confusion from Anita's other sisters, Teresa and Valerie.
And she stopped coming by, and I didn't know what had happened, but Dad told me that she had came up missing.
My last words to my sister was, "Don't go, please don't go."
She mattered in a real way for people that knew her, knew of her, and never had a chance to even reconcile her disappearance. You know, it's why we have obituaries. It's why when people die, it's put in the paper, because you want to say, like, this person lived, this person mattered to people, and this person actually lived. And so being able to put her name out there and allow people to know that she was someone to someone is really important.
Coming up, I continue my conversation with Fresh Air host Tanya Mosley and her nephew Antonio Wiley about their new podcast, She Has a Name. I'm Brittany Luce, and you're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
This week on Code Switch, we're talking about white American evangelicals and Israel.
Israel is not a political issue. Israel is a Bible issue.
Make no mistake, God has blessed Israel.
Then on Life Kit, strategies to help you navigate without a GPS.
As you're navigating somewhere, you know, just turn around and look at where you came from.
That's on Code Switch and Life Kit from NPR.
Code Switch is next, and then at 10 o'clock, The Splendid Table.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Buying and cooking seafood at home can be intimidating for a lot of people, but we've got just the fix for that. And no, you don't have to start by making friends with a fishmonger. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from StoryWorth. Each week, StoryWorth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, they'll publish family memories into a bound book to keep forever. Learn more at StoryWorth.com. From Made in Cookware, Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for chefs and designed for restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at MadeinCookware.com. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
You're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Brittany Luce, and I'm continuing my conversation with Fresh Air host Tanya Mosley and her nephew Antonio Wiley about their new podcast, She Has a Name. And a warning, this segment touches on a violent death. Antonio, what's been the significance of matching a name to your mom's story?
It's been a long time coming, and to finally be able to lay her to rest in an honorable way has been the biggest gift to me. Recently, we laid a headstone at her grave, and now we have a place and a space to honor her.
It's very massive that's something that y'all have been able to do now in recent years. In the second episode of your series titled Natural Born Hustler, you share memories of younger Anita from friends and family. And you took a real break from the finding out what happened and really learned who she was instead.
She was outgoing and, you know how to put on her makeup and a dresser. She was a dresser. I mean, stay sharp every day.
I mean, obviously, Antonio, you know, you knew her as a child, but it was interesting to hear from other people how she was as a child. Antonio, I'd love to hear from you. Like, talk to me about what it's been like for you to find out so many lovable things about your mother and include them in this project.
When I think of my mother, you know, it was as a child. She was my protector, best friend. She was everything to me. Mm. Caregiver, tutor, teacher, style coach. I mean, you name it, you know, she was it. But to hear that from other people touches my heart. in a real way, because it validates who she was as a person. We've been getting some replies and correspondences from people since the podcast has launched, kind of echoing that sentiment. So to learn that about her, it just really is the win in myself.
You know, I've gotten so much out of listening to this series, and it's so thoughtfully done, but parts of it are challenging to listen to. You know, you're finding out things about each other and yourselves and your family for the first time, while also processing details about, you know, the disappearance and death of a loved one. Eventually, you find out that Anita was the victim of a shocking and violent murder, and the podcast goes into detail about that. And there are still, to this day, a lot of unresolved questions about who killed her and why. I imagine on some level, you both knew that working on this could take an emotional toll, and yet you still did it. What drove you to turn your family story into an investigative series?
So I start off the series talking about how, as a journalist, I cover missing persons cases throughout my career. Mm-hmm. Then there's always been this other component of that, like how we underreport Black missing people, specifically women of color. But really, it wasn't until finding Anita's remains that I thought about, okay, if we're going to tell this story, we have to almost, by laying ourselves bare, lay out why other Black women's stories aren't being told. You know, in the media, we want a perfect victim. We want someone who was, oh, she's a wholesome family woman who was married and two kids and went to college, and she just disappeared one day.
Right.
So to say that Anita also has a name is also to acknowledge that she's human, and to acknowledge her humanity in a way that allows you to understand what ultimately led to her disappearance and death. It felt really gratifying for Antonio and I to have this ability to be able to unpack that for ourselves too.
I think there are so many families who have some of these subjects we can't talk about or things that we don't want to get into, and that gets passed down. And it's really interesting to see how you all went there and shared some of the experiences that Anita had gone through. She'd been a teen mother. She had been involved in the drug game. She got mixed up with the wrong guy. I mean, these details, when you put them up against the definition of society's perfect victim, it can be incongruent. But in real life, almost everybody has either been that person or has known and loved that person.
Absolutely. Yep.
I think that that also was very interesting, the way that you all embraced the reality of the family history that you were trying to explore.
To do anything less would have been a diminishment of the story itself. Hmm. I had one woman who contacted me and said, I just want to tell you about my sister. She was a sex worker and she disappeared in 1980 and I've never seen her since. And I carry this with me. And when I heard Antonio say, you can't really tell people this thing, but this is the thing that actually guides your life and directs your path, but yet you can't talk about it because it changes your relationships with people when they know, she saw herself in Antonio. Hmm. And so how are we able to get to the truth and actually really tell the story if we didn't go there?
You spend significant time also placing her life and death in a wider context of Detroit. You spent time exploring how the city of Detroit both made Anita in so many beautiful ways, but also the city failed her and her memory in so many other ways. Things that were happening in Detroit during her life contributed to the conditions that led to Anita going missing, you know, like the crack epidemic, the struggling auto industry, continuing white flight to nearby suburbs, and a lack of investment in the Black people who stayed behind. You know, in an interview in Vanity Fair, Tanya, you said, Detroiters feel displaced in it all. And part of why they feel displaced is because they haven't had a chance. No one has actually stopped and acknowledged what happened to them, the survivors. How do you see this series as addressing that lack of acknowledgement that you described?
This is the topic that really does make me emotional. So bear with me here. But just recently we had an event in Detroit where we had the community come together and we recorded a live show. And in the audience, there was a whole row of women, actually two rows of women, who were Anita's age. They were her friends
and some of her family members, and there were some of my family there, and then there was some of my mom's friends, and they're all like in their 60s and 70s, because that's where Anita would be now. And all of them have told me how much they feel seen, how much they feel seen by this series. And the people that we were able to interview for this, at the end of every conversation I've had with every one of the Black women I've interviewed, they've said, thank you for letting me tell my story. And I think we're talking a little bit about Anita and we're talking a little bit about you, but wow, that's more than you've ever had the opportunity to talk about the things that happened to you. And I think it's healing too. And that's just the gift of being able to talk about it.
Yeah, I think people have lived with this for their entire adult life, including myself, being able to come forth into the light of their own truth has been a very powerful experience, not just for me, but for everyone that's been involved in this process. So I think the bigger picture would be to help others come forth with their truth and use our example as somewhat of a template of how it could be done. And like Tanya alluded to, the healing that comes out of such an exercise.
You're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Brittany Luce, here with Fresh Air co-host Tanya Mosley and her nephew, Antonio Wiley. They're producers of a new podcast called She Has a Name, which follows the death and disappearance of Tanya's half-sister, Anita.
I want to talk more about some of that healing, specifically from your perspective, Antonio. I mean, one thing that stood out to me about this series that's different than other documentary series that I've heard that have covered similar topics is the way that you all address Black men's mental health and wellness in the wake of tragedy.
You know, I see myself in the youth of today dealing with a lot of that. They may not share the same experience that I do. But growing up in urban areas, you know, you're faced with the same circumstances, either personally or know someone who have been, right? Where do you turn for help or for guidance? That's what's missing. We wanted to bring that aspect of our experience into the conversation. Tanya held my hand the whole way, which was big to me because that's the stigma, you know, of young Black men in urban areas, if not the country. But what we hope to show is that there is, if you can confront your own challenges in a way where you're sincere about not only finding solutions, but then also finding a way forward.
Now that the podcast is out, I wonder, what does healing continue to look like for your family? And what have you learned from each other about healing in the wake of tragedy?
You know, the number one thing that has come out of this podcast for me is opening up the conversation with my family about really tough things and also forgiving ourselves for some of the choices that we made. It really shows me that there is so much power to storytelling beyond just the gratification of entertainment, like, you know, just being able to sit in someone else's story for a moment. There's a real chance to be able to reflect on one's own life through other people's stories that allow us to heal for ourselves.
What about you, Antonio?
That it's okay to be vulnerable. It's okay to confront your past. We all have a story, right? And no one's perfect. So, you know, it's given us all courage to confront these things that we've carried with us for a long time. And now we're starting to finally put them back in their place, take the lesson that it gave us forward into the future, and put stops in place so these things won't happen again.
Oh, my gosh. Tanya, Antonio, thank you so much. I can't tell you how much I appreciate this. This was really, really special.
I appreciate this, too. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Antonio Wiley and Tanya Mosley. You can listen to She Has a Name wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Brittany Luce, and you're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Hey, Brittany.
Hey, Brittany.
Hey, Brittany.
Hey, Brittany. My name is Yamari. I'm from Brooklyn, New York, via Trinidad and Tobago. And my song for the summer is Freetown Collective's Rainy Mornings, because the whole song is just beautiful love vibes.
Yamari, thank you so much for calling in with such a beautiful suggestion for Song of the Summer, Freetown Collective's Rainy Mornings. I will tell you this, if you haven't heard this song, one day if you're feeling a little good, get up in the morning, throw open those curtains. This is a song I feel like that would be perfect to wake up to. I guess that's why it's called Rainy Mornings. It just has this like a beautiful little vibey groove to it.
I wanna be your only one, yeah. Lightning and thunder when she have it on. She never make me wonder if she love me though.
Yeah, I definitely see why you have been feeling this for your song of the summer. Oh, good choice. But as far as I'm concerned, I think I might have mentioned this on a previous episode. Right now, my early pick for song of the summer is Nasty by Tinashe. Now, let me back up by saying I'm a big Tinashe fan. And if you don't know who Tinashe is, allow me to enlighten you. She is a phenomenal American pop singer. She, to me, is like a quadruple threat. She can sing, she can dance, she can write and produce. If you don't know Tinashe, you probably have heard this song somewhere. You've heard it somewhere scrolling on social media. You've heard it out of a car window as it's buzzing past you in the street. And right now, I think that it is the best shot we have at a song for the summer in 2024. And I'm going to tell you why. Number one, it's got a little bit of repetition. Repetition works really, really well in songs of summer. That repetitive background kind of thrum that drove its way through the entire song. Tinashe singing, I've been a nasty girl, nasty. Okay. Over and over and over again. That line has hooked into half of America's ears, at least. Okay. And it's not coming out. Another thing that makes this song, I think, just a perfect summer song is that it's really easy to dance to. It's got like a perfect little kind of like syncopated beat with a little attitude to it. And I'll say one of the best parts about this song becoming so popular are the videos that I've seen online of people either dancing to this song or of people taking dance videos from other social media clips, from movie scenes, from television shows, and taking out the original sound and replacing it with Tinashe's Nasty, okay? I could go on and on and on about all of the virtues of Tinashe's song of the summer, Nasty, but I'm gonna leave it right there. And whatever you think the song of the summer is, I hope that you get to hear it this weekend and dance to your heart's content. Thanks again so much for calling in. Now, if you submitted a question or response to a segment for Hey Brittany in the past few weeks, you are in luck. Next week is a special Hey Brittany mailbag episode where I respond to listener letters from all of you. If you'd like to be featured in a future Hey Brittany mailbag, send us a voice memo at ibam@npr.org. That's ibam@npr.org. This episode of It's Been a Minute was produced by
Barton Girdwood,
Alexis Williams,
Liam McBain,
Corey Antonio Rose.
This episode was edited by
Jessica Plachek,
Sarah Saracen.
Engineering support came from
Ko Takasugi Chernobin,
Kwesi Lee.
We had fact-checking help from
Cecile Davis Vasquez.
Our executive producer is
Verilyn Williams.
Our VP of programming is
Yolanda Sanguini.
All right, that's all for this episode of It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Brittany Luce. Talk soon.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 35,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere at betterhelp.com/public. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
To truly understand the news, you need a global perspective. NewsHour from the BBC brings you reports from around the world, voices from where the stories are happening, and analysis from experts, helping you make sense of the most important stories of the day. That's NewsHour from the BBC.
BBC coming up at 11 o'clock. Make this summer unforgettable with KQED's Summer Guides. From thrilling concerts to captivating art shows, we've got your guide to all the must-see events. Explore more at kqed.org/summerguide2024. The announcers and technical staff of KQED Radio are affiliated with the National Association of Broadcast Employees and Technicians, CWA Local 51 AFL-CIO. A warming trend coming up Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. We're going to see temperatures from the upper 60s to the upper 90s inland. I'm Sandy Althaus, and you're listening to Member Supported, KQED-FM San Francisco, KQEI-FM North Highlands.
Today on Code Switch, white American evangelicals and Israel.